not quite 7 o'clock, but I like to chat with people before we get started. At about 7, our center manager's going to come up and talk a little bit. But while people are filing in, just wondering how many people have never been here before? Oh, my, quite a few. Well, thank you so much for taking the leap and coming here tonight. Just a little orientation. We are in a room that's called the Gompa, G-O-M-P-A. The word Gom is Tibetan for to become familiar with. So this is a room in which we all gather to become familiar with the teachings, but also to become familiar with our own minds and thoughts and our aspirations. So that's why we always enjoy coming into this room. You'll see a lot of things around here. These big banners. They're called Tonkas, but it's spelled like Thanga, T-H-A-N-G. K-A. My spelling is off, right? And these, the Tonkas, were originally used to convey education, teachings. Just like stained glass windows in Gothic cathedrals, it was a way of helping to explain the teachings to people who were not literate, but also it was a way of focusing your attention and reviewing the teachings, even if you were able to read and you were very knowledgeable. And it's still something that is used today for that purpose. The prayer flags you see hanging here, I bet everybody has seen these in pictures of the Himalayas and everywhere around. And they're called prayer flags, and that's exactly what they do and are. There is a prayer on each one of these flags, and each set can have a different prayer on them. Sometimes it's a prayer for the Kala Chakra, prayer for world peace, or it can be the Medicine Buddha prayer for healing, or it can have a combination of prayers. And all they are is like a mental cue to when you see the flags with a color. All the colors, of course, have other meanings, but when you think of whoever intentionally put that prayer there and what that prayer says, you think of that prayer, and as the flags move in the breeze, you mentally think that these prayers go with the wind and travel to all sentient beings all over the universe. So that's our little blurb getting set up. Maybe everybody is here now. It's just about 7 o'clock, so I'll pass it off to... Oh, okay. This is our fearless leader.
Well, I haven't been here before with Elise, so just those few minutes show me... Awesome. That's just, it's really lovely to hear how her voice is so gentle, too. And so what she said is beautiful. I haven't even heard some of these. She is a stained glass artist. So I thought, as she was getting ready to say it, I thought, I bet that's why they appeal to you so much, because that
could be.
Yeah, that's really beautiful little piece of information, little nugget for tonight. So since so many of you are new, we'd like to just come in and say hello and welcome and just have some different faces. Hey, Glenn. There's an old face we know. So some of the things I like to tell people about that they may not know, a lot of times churches, maybe Catholic churches are open, but a lot of centers aren't open all day long. And so like Brian came in the other day, we met, had a little chat. You can come in during the day and meditate. You can use this Gompa by yourself, which is really lovely, very quiet. You can look at the bookstore. We're always welcome. You're always welcome to shop. You can use the library and just look at books. You can come have lunch on Fridays with me. I'll sit with whoever comes in and have lunch at noon. You can use the grounds, go around the stupa. So it's, you're welcome to use it. You can tell your friends too. They're welcome to come in and use it. So one thing that a lot of people who are new and the people who are old have heard this a lot, but Glenn is a really good one too. He brought some new information one time about how everything we do is freely offered, so we don't charge for the classes. And most churches don't charge, you know, to come in on Sunday, but they do donate. People do donate. But we have so many classes, like a lot of retreats and weekend workshops and visiting teachers. We have a lot of visiting teachers, so it's really an active center. So we still don't charge for any of that, but you can imagine it takes a lot of money to keep this place open and keep the doors, you know, keep me paid and all that good stuff. So one time Glenn traveled and he came back and said, wow, I forgot that people charge, and they, what was it, $12 a class?
$7
for Sunday morning class. So that would be unusual for us, but it's normal everywhere else. And then a workshop might be like $140 or something. So sometimes we need to hear those things to understand that we are all responsible to keep the doors open and the lights on. So if you are moved, so there's little slips to help you how to text give, which is really thrilling if you've never done it. And that slip is in the back by the, you can point to it there. There's our Carol Merrill, or Vanna White, that ages me. So, and then there's boxes around, there's a website you can go to, so there's a lot of ways to give, checks, cash, anything's fine that you'd like to do. You can also offer service. So that's one thing that new people, it would be odd to just come in and start doing things. But if you wanted to sweep, you wanted to clean the toilet, you wanted to do different things, you could come early and start to help out in ways. It's kind of cool to do that, just be here and it's peaceful. And to think about one night, I was sitting here brand new, just like you, and I mean, how'd this happen? How'd I become the manager of this place? So maybe you'll be the next center manager one day. If you fall in love with the place like I did, you'll love it here. So welcome, and you're in for a real treat with Elise. So enjoy yourself. And I always ask people to make a commitment to come all 5 weeks. It's easy to let life get in the way and just go, oh, don't worry about it. But if you seriously make a commitment, this is such a rare opportunity to get a solid 5 weeks of, it goes together so well. The book out in the bookstore will explain it too with the CD. So try to commit to yourself, I am going to go to all 5 weeks. And I want to get the whole picture, because then I'll know and I can make decisions or do whatever I want to do from there. In the bookstore, tonight's the last night for a sale on any book from His Holiness. Buy one, get one, the other one half off, because his birthday was Thursday. Thank you, and I pass it over to you.
I keep thinking it would be so wonderful if the bank and the power company would operate the way we do, that you only pay what you can afford. But since we have to pay no matter what, that's why we keep having to say these things we don't want to say about money. Okay, so my name is Elise Strievel. I happen to double as the outreach coordinator here for the center. I've been coming to the Kadampa Center since about 2004, so I'm a continuing student here. So I will try my best to give you good information, but it's just me, so I can make mistakes. But if those mistakes are mine, not anybody else's. If you ever have questions when you leave here that you'd like to direct to me, I can be reached at the address outreach@kadampacenter.org. And if you forget that, you could just go to our website, look up the management team, and you can email me through that. Okay, so our plan for tonight is to give you a little introduction to the Kadampa Center, a little introduction to what this course is. We'll talk a little about the life of Shakyamuni Buddha and the Four Noble Truths, and we'll do a brief introduction to meditation. But before we get started with all that, our habit is to start by setting an intention, and all of us could have been somewhere else tonight, at home, relaxing, doing something maybe more exciting than coming to the Kadampa Center, but we want to improve our minds, to improve ourselves, so that we can then have peace in our hearts and our minds and spread that to people next to us and to next to that, till our whole community and the world is living in quiet and peace. So that's our intention for tonight, and thank you all so much for being here. So this is my little disclaimer cartoon here. What I know about Buddhism, the green is research, blue is school, the light yellow Buddhist people, and the other one is the Simpsons episode where Lisa becomes a Buddhist. Not really. You know, like I said, I've been a student for a long time and I try to pay attention. Okay. So the Kadampa Center started in the 70s and 80s. Dr. Don Brown, who is a medical doctor in the area, went to India after medical school, and he became a student of Lama Yeshe. Lama Yeshe's picture is up here. Maybe not all of you can see it. It's right this one here. But it's also out in the lobby to the left of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's picture when you first walk in. Lama Yeshe was really an unusual monk in that in the 70s and 80s when the hippies went over to India to learn transcendental meditation and just learn a whole new lifestyle, not many Buddhist monks were willing to teach the Westerners because, not because they were selfish or didn't think that the Westerners were smart, but they had this basic understanding or thought that the Western mind was just very different from the Eastern mindset. And we all kind of have a sense of that as well, don't we? And they just really felt like Westerners would not understand, wouldn't get it, what they were trying to explain. So most Buddhist teachers did not want to teach these hippies. But Lama Yeshe sensed something different. He said, I think these Westerners will be better students than any because they've already been in the West where they have all the material goods that much of the rest of the world don't have. And they have experienced that that does not bring them happiness, that something deeper is needed. And that's why they're seeking. So I think that their minds are ready. And he was one of the first Buddhist monks that was willing to teach the Westerners and learned English in order to do so. And Don Brown was one of his students, and look what bloomed from that. Don Brown then came to set up his practice in the Triangle area, and he really wanted to practice with a few other people. So he got together a couple of people. They met in people's living rooms for a while. Then in 1990, they got large enough to rent a room. And the room was a room that was like half the size of this in the basement of an office complex down Chapel Hill Road. And it was dingy and yucky, and they fixed it up and met there for quite a while. And then in 1990, Don Brown asked Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who was Lama Yeshe's associate, because Lama Yeshe passed away in 1984. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche went around teaching with Lama Yeshe. So when Lama Yeshe passed away, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's to the right, and you can't see him very well here, but again, his picture is out in the lobby next to the giant portrait of His Holiness. He is still the head of the FPMT, which I'll explain in a moment. So Lama Zopa gave a name to this center that was just really a handful of people at this point. He named it Kadampa, and Kadam means to take each word of the teachings as a practice. And pa means place. So this is a place where we can take each word of the teachings as practice. And it was enrolled as an FPMT center. Like I said, Lama Zopa Rinpoche is the head of the FPMT. Now, what does that mean? That's the foundation for the practice of Mahayana, foundation for the preservation of the Mahayana tradition. Okay? The foundation for the preservation of the Mahayana tradition. Now, what does that mean? Now, Buddhism, there's several traditions. There's Theravada, the Mahayana, and Vajrayana, which we'll talk about in future classes. But the Tibetan Buddhism is part of the Mahayana tradition. And there was a concern that when the teachings were passed from one to another to another to another, like that old game of gossip, things might change and it might lose its essence. And so this organization was formed to sort of be like the UL stamp or the Good Housekeeping stamp of approval on certain things. So when you learn that a center is an FPMT, you know that the things that are taught in that center, the books that are sold in that center, the activities that are associated with that center, all make a great effort to provide authentic teachings and a great authenticity to everything that you are learning. That we have teachers who have studied for a long time through reliable sources, and you can take these teachings for the truth. It does not mean that if you go to a center that is not FPMT, it doesn't mean that they're bad or not giving you the right information, but you can't be certain of it. Just like if you buy a product that hasn't been inspected, it might be great, but it may not be. So then in 1992, Dr. Robbie Watkins arrived, and he became the center director. And I'll tell you, this is really something remarkable. In 1992, he became the director. He still is the director. And that is really, really unusual. It's a very difficult, demanding position. A lot of decisions to be made about all kinds of things all the time. And we are so grateful that he has the patience and the stick-to-itness to stay in that position, because it's very valuable to have someone in that role who has a history of the center and is extremely knowledgeable in the Buddhist tradition. So then from the 1990 or up until 1999, the only authentic or highly trained teachers, monks, and international teachers that the center had were visiting teachers. They weren't large enough and didn't have the facilities to have a teacher of their own. In fact, most FPMT centers around the world, and there honestly really aren't that many of them, even all around the world, we're very fortunate to have one here. Many of them do not have resident teachers, so they depend on teachers traveling and spending a few days, few weeks, sometimes few months, in a few cases a year or two at a time, but they're not permanent teachers in the centers. But we are so amazingly fortunate that in 1999, Geshe Gelug was appointed to come here to Raleigh, to the Kadampa Center, to be our resident teacher. Now, Geshe is a degree. Okay, Geshe Gelug means, it's like saying Dr. Brown or, you know, Professor Smith, okay? Geshe is a degree that is bestowed after decades of studying. It's like a PhD on steroids, okay? A PhD takes, you know, through college and maybe up to 4 years of study and a dissertation after that. In order to earn a Geshe degree, it takes anywhere from 25 to 40 years of intensive study. In order to be a Geshe, you have to memorize texts. Like these are 108 texts, these little tabs there. They're books, Tibetan-style books. They're strips of parchment stacked with writing on each side wrapped in a cloth. And to be a Geshe, you have to memorize all of those and many other teachings. And then in order to get the degree, you have to be able to argue points in debate and quote the teachings exactly, word for word, be able to locate that, what you're citing, and it has to be exact. And these books don't have indexes or page numbers. So that's, I really couldn't do it. And I thought, it's impossible for someone to do that. But you know what, it's not. They start training at a very young age to memorize. In fact, a little quick side thing, the Dalai Lama is very interested in science, as you've probably all read all of the time, and he's really wanting the monks in the monasteries in India to get more and more science teachings. So I read an article in a science magazine about how some scientists from Harvard or Yale went to teach a course at one of the monasteries, and he said, here I was standing at the front of the class explaining some very complex ideas about physics or genetics or something really complex, and all the students were just sitting there quietly looking at me without taking any notes, without looking at any books. And I thought, this is just above their heads, you know, they just, I assume too much. But then at the end of his lecture, they started asking questions that showed him they understood every bit, they understood and memorized and were spewing back some very complex questions, which confirmed that they understood. So it just shows, like, I guess I'm just really used to, like, writing everything down and having the books, you know. So anyway, that's off the point, isn't it? Okay, so we were in that little basement building, and 2007, we finally got big enough and got booted out of our old place, coincidentally, because they sold the building, and we bought this place here. And this was originally, before we moved in here, they sold fish for ponds, and so there had been a lot of aquariums in here, so it was all mold, and volunteers just ripped it to the gut and fixed everything what you see here with the help, consultation from just one contractor. So we are all sitting here at the grace of many, many volunteers. Okay, so this little red asterisk here, whenever you see it, it means that if you go to our website and look under Spiritual Programs Introductory Classes and see Buddhism in a Nutshell, there are these sheets are available for you, these information sheets are available for you to download and print out or read. So that's what that means, okay? So Buddhism in a Nutshell is just a general overview of the basic Buddhist philosophy, what Buddhism is, who the Buddha is, some of his teachings, and a brief introduction to meditation. This class alternates with a 5-week class that's called Meditation 101, which is similar in that it focuses just on the beginnings of how to meditate and what meditation is, even though we'll mention it a little bit here in this class. This assumes only that you're interested in learning about Buddhism. We are not about converting, okay, sorry. But and we're learning about Buddhism not only does not mean that you need to or should even consider giving up any other kind of philosophy or spiritual practice that you have. This can, learning about Buddhist philosophy and principles can actually enhance what you're already working on. And if you are just kind of floating and don't have anything, this can be used as something that you can work with. We're going to meet for 5 Tuesdays. And after you've done these 5 classes and you think, hey, I really want to learn a little bit more about that, the next level up is a class called Discovering Buddhism, which is offered on Monday nights. And here in these 5 classes, we're doing all of Buddhism in 5 weeks. The Discovering Buddhism will take one topic and study it for 5 weeks, like karma or nirvana or something. Okay? Okay, so now we jump into it. What is Buddhism? Is it a philosophy? Is it a religion? Is it a culture? It's actually all of those things, any of those things, individually or collectively. Buddhism basically is, it's about the mind, a way of thinking, a way of perceiving, interpreting life. It's how to control your mind. It's developing a mind that's flexible, calm, compassionate, and wise. View it as a theory, as a way of seeing the world. Think about it. Test it out. It's all about living what you are learning. Buddhism, if you're a serious student of Buddhism, you will find that it is not a lazy philosophy. You really, you can't just go and read a book and say, oh, that's really nice. It is required if you really want to benefit. You take one little bite at a time, a little bite, and you chew it, and you think about it, you test it out, then you go on to the next thing. You don't just, like, memorize things. There's multiple lists. You know, there's no shortage of lists and information in Buddhism. But the way to do it is not to just go through the lists and memorize the lists. Just start a little bit at a time. So for Buddhism, what I would like you to think about is that in the West especially, one way of viewing the world, a popular way of viewing the world, why we're here, why things happen, why we suffer, what makes us happy, One view of that is there is a supreme being who is directing all of these things. Okay, so one way of viewing it is there's a supreme being that's saying, I'm allowing this suffering or I'm causing this suffering to happen. So if you want to stop that suffering, what do you do? Well, you can appeal to that supreme being, or you can try and figure out, you know, what the supreme being wants. You know, that's one way of viewing things, okay? In Buddhism, it's not viewed through the perspective of a supreme creator or a supreme being or a supreme power. Instead, it's a way of looking at things as cause and effect, step by step, of studying what you are thinking, why you were thinking it, how you were thinking it, okay? So it's a different way of viewing the world. So remember that as we go through. And you're also going to hear a lot of words that you think you know the definition to, like you think you know, oh, mind, yeah, so this is a thing inside of our skull, right? No. And when we're talking through Buddhism, it's important for you to pay attention to the words that we use and how we define them in Buddhism. It's always an unfortunate thing when you're translating masses of teachings from one language to another. It's even more difficult when it's not just a language, but it's a whole culture. So the words that we are using that the Buddhist thoughts are translated into don't always convey exactly what they might be trying to say. So pay attention to the words. Meditation, Buddha, all of these things, that pay attention to how they're used in Buddhism and try as hard as you can to put aside what you might think that word means. This here is a little blurb from His Holiness the Dalai Lama that I think is a great definition of what Buddhism is. The very purpose of religion is to control yourself, not to criticize others. Rather, we must criticize ourselves. How much am I doing about my anger, about my attachment, about my pride, my jealousy? These are the things which we must check in daily life. Take your own body and mind as the laboratory. Engage in some thorough research on your own mental functioning and examine the possibility of making some positive changes within yourself. All right? Here's a little cartoon that the meaning of life, we're still trying to answer this timeless question, what is the meaning of life? If Google ever goes away, we're all in a lot of trouble, aren't we? Okay. Well, this timeless question is one that the Buddha also had. It is a timeless question. We've always been thinking about these things. So, who is Shakyamuni Buddha? That's kind of a hard word for me to say, but Shakya means is the clan of the historical Buddha, which is located in the present day Nepal. Muni means sage, Buddha means a fully enlightened being. So, he is the fully enlightened sage from the Shakya clan. Okay, so, we think, it's commonly kind of assumed, when we talk about the Buddha, that Buddha was his name. No, Buddha is a term. Buddha means someone who is fully enlightened. And what does enlightenment mean? It means when your mind and positive potential is fully realized. It's a state of perfect compassion and wisdom and skill. Don't we all want that, right? Well, it is possible for every one of us to also become a Buddha. It's in the potential in every one of us. So the Buddha that we refer to when we talk, say, the Buddha, we always think about this guy up here, okay, the historic Buddha. Okay, he's the historic Buddha. That means that he is very, very important to us, but he was not the first Buddha. He was not the first enlightened being. There were many before him. He was not the only one at his time. There were many others with him. And he's not the last one. There are many from his time to this present day and in the future. There are many, many enlightened beings. So why is this guy so important? Well, I kind of compare it to, like, why is Einstein so important? You know, as Einstein, we all generally agree that he was a physics genius, right? And was he the only physics genius? No, there were many before him. There were many at the same time as him, and there are many since him. But why do we think he is so important? Well, it's because he had the ability to understand all of these complex ideas, just like the Shakyamuni Buddha. He had the capacity to think and study and understand how things work. And he had the ability to communicate those ideas in a way that people could understand. And it was a time in history or in culture, whatever, that people were ready to receive that information. Okay? So like if Einstein tried to talk about, warps in space in the year zero, you know, who would be able to receive it, right? So it's a combination of all of those things, of having the capacity to achieve that level of thought, to having the capacity to communicate it, and also people around having the capacity to receive it. So that's why this guy is so important to us. We don't worship him. We respect and appreciate him as a great teacher who was able to bring these teachings to us. So the historic Buddha was a real guy, okay? There's evidence in history that he existed. This is where he was born. So I'm showing you a few things here that are, you know, some people like to take pilgrimages and actually experience these places. But this is where he was born as Prince Siddhartha 2,500 years ago, questioning the meaning of life and found no answers in luxury or deprivation. This is Bodhigaya, where he became enlightened. For 6 years he sat and thought about how things exist. This is next thing is a big departure from many, many other faith streams, that what he thought about was not considered by him or anybody a divine revelation. It didn't just like come from the air and come to him as a divine revelation, okay? That may or may not be true for others, but that is, for the Buddha, it is not true. He was not a divine revelation. It means that he, like a scientist, really, sat and tried to figure out, why do we suffer? Why is there illness and death and unhappiness and dissatisfaction? What causes it? How can we, if we know what the cause is, then maybe we can backpedal and eliminate those causes. So he sat for 6 years after he realized that having all the physical wealth of a prince didn't cut it. And then he went and lived the life of an ascetic, starved himself, lived out in the world, in nature, and the wind and the rain, and that didn't do it. So he decided on what we call the middle way, that you know, he needs to not have so much opulence that it's distracting, but he needs to not treat himself so badly that he's physically unable to think and study and be distracted by growling stomachs, right? So the middle way, where you're comfortable enough to pursue a spiritual life and thinking, that's the deal, okay? But it didn't come easily, okay? We all want this instant karma, this instant nirvana, but sorry. It's just like, you know, one day you just want to lose 50 pounds, and it just doesn't happen overnight. Or, you know, you want to be a PhD student, you can't do that overnight. It takes a lot of time and effort. And he actually lived for quite a while. He taught for 50 years, did a lot of traveling around. Sarnath is also known as Deer Park, is where he did the first teaching. His first public teaching was known as the Four Noble Truths. Now, noble doesn't mean royalty. It means of high regard, okay, of a high value. And so the Four Noble Truths, and you see a little star up there that means that you also have a sheet. It talks about the Four Noble Truths in your online. And basically, it talks about first noble truth is suffering exists. Second, it has a cause. It can be ended. And there is a way to end it. And it's often compared to a medical analogy that suffering is an illness. It has a diagnosis, there's a prescription, and a treatment to it. So after all this time, and you know, he comes out after these 6 years under the Bodhi tree, and he's serene and calm. Everyone can tell he's really happy. He's like a transformed person, and they all want some of this. They want to be like that. So they begged him to teach. He didn't really want to because, like actually what we were talking about before, the monks in the East were concerned that people just wouldn't be able to understand what he's trying to express. But they begged him, please help us, please teach. So he says, all right. So his first teaching is suffering exists. Like, how happy is that? You know, like, what kind of an attitude is it? But the reason that he started with this is because people can all recognize, no matter who you are, what conditions you live in, you recognize suffering. We've all experienced some kind of suffering, all of us. So we know that this is the truth. We know that suffering exists. And by the way, the real meaning of suffering in Buddhism is not just the physical suffering. In fact, really, it's not the physical suffering. It really can be more accurately translated as dissatisfaction. And boy, we can all identify with that, can't we? Dissatisfaction with what we are, what's around us, the way the world is, just where dissatisfaction permeates our lives. And he's telling you, yeah, you all know that suffering exists, this dissatisfaction exists. But, you know, think about what's causing it. That's something we do not really think about, or we'll think about it in a very superficial way. You know, I'm unhappy because, you know, Johnny was mean to me. You know, he didn't have to do that. But we don't really think about, like, extenuating circumstances and really think about, you know, like, well, why was he mean to me? What were the contributing factors? What could I have done differently? Or how can I encounter this differently the next time? Okay, so we don't really think about the cause. And so once you know what causes it, then you can apply the right remedy. And the path to end it is, there's different paths of studying that you can do in the Buddhist philosophy. And you may find other ways, but we are showing you one that you've all gathered here tonight to learn a little bit about. Okay, let me see what's next. Oh. Kushinagar, Buddha passed into parinirvana, the ultimate teaching on impermanence, which is a basic tenet in Buddhist philosophy, impermanence. And it just shows that even the Buddha's body was not permanent. Okay. I'm not exactly sure what that peri-nirvana word actually means. I tried to look it up and then I got distracted. I'm not mindful. Okay, so I once found this definition of the Buddha that I think is really great, because so many people think, who is the Buddha? So he's like Jesus, or is he like God? Do you worship him? No, none of those things. This definition came from, there was a tour of a big, beautiful jade Buddha statue around the world years ago. The Buddha, neither divinity, he's not divinity, nor supreme chief, he is the most venerable personage, for he is the embodiment of immense compassion and infinite wisdom. So the Buddha, this Buddha, along with many, many other Buddhas like we talked about, the Buddha is someone he doesn't have superpowers, okay? He's not the head of the world or the universe. He is someone who shows the potential that we all have to be perfectly compassionate and wise and skillful. So he was definitely a person, a human being like we are, which is showing that he died and his body died, just as ours will, just kind of shows that he was really a person. There's historic proof that he was a person like us, and he was able to achieve these qualities. We can too. He was not different from us. Maybe a little more tenacious than I am. Okay, let me see what's next here. I wonder if this is a good place to stop for questions. Okay, yes, are there any questions at this point? Yeah, are you going to use the microphone for make sure that everyone can hear, for one thing? Because if anyone has a question, you can guarantee your bottom boot that other people have that same question. And we're also putting this on the internet so people who can't physically be here can hear it as well. Yes.
Hi. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thank you.
I was curious if you could talk a little bit more about the consecration of this building and who came and consecrated the land and consecrated the stupa, and if you want to talk a little bit more about the history of the stupa outside, I would love to hear it.
Okay. I'll just cover that briefly, because, and then if you need more information, we'll cover that later. But it is the belief here that when you use the word consecration or blessing, think about what does that mean? What is the word blessing? Consecrating means offering a blessing, you know, blessing. What does the word blessing mean? Blessing means positive change. When you say, let us bless this place, bless me, I pray for blessings, what are we saying? We're saying, please give us the capacity, the mindset, the potential, a realized potential for positive change. So really what blesses this place are the people who come here, are the people who come here with the positive intentions to change themselves in a positive way. And that is what any of our teachers would say. It's not the place, it's not the people, someone else can't do it for you. It's the collective energy that we bring here that makes this the holy place, because it's what's inside of us, it's coming out, we share it, and it grows exponentially. And that's the value of having a place that we can gather together to. On Sunday mornings, our teacher really likes the children to stay in the room, and all of us together make some chants or say some prayers together, because the collective energy is multiplied when we do it together. And we all sense that, don't we? But there were some little rituals to just kind of be a little ritual of like a grand opening, I guess. And our Lama Zopa Rinpoche did come after we'd been opened, and we had gatherings of people and little ceremonies. But that's not really what blessed it. And the stupa, yes. Yeah. Please go ahead, Hetty.
Yeah, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's the head of FPMT, had suggested we build a stupa. So it was his wish that we build one. And so we collected money and built it. Actually, a Tibetan artist came and carved, all that's carved cement. They carved Jean-Paul. He actually lives in the area now. And then after it was built, Lama Zopa visited again and did some ceremonies over it. So, you know, it was his wish for us to build the stupa.
He's the head of the FPMT. Yeah. Thank you, Hetty. That was great. There was another question.
There's a question: what is a stupa?
What is a stupa? That's a very good question, because I kind of wondered that myself, and I've done a lot of reading about it. And my understanding, okay, from my reading, is that, first of all, what it's commonly or collectively understood is a stupa is a holy monument or object that contains relics of special teachers, along with many other things, and many other representations of the qualities that we strive to achieve to be better people and to become enlightened. But the little history that I found about stupas was that in the Tibetan area, which is very mountainous and, of course, is very sparsely populated, when somebody died, of course, like we all do, build a little gravestone, a little stupa, a little pile of rocks, okay, to mark the place that where someone's bones are laid to rest or relics. Well, when there would be a very special recognized teacher, someone who was considered to be really special and holy, when that person would die, of course, they would build a little bit nicer one so that people would recognize that spot, so that they could come and feel the energy, just like when we go visit a family's grave. Why do we go there? Because there's something about knowing that their remains are there. We just kind of share it, that energy, the thoughts with them, right? Same thing with these holy people. So, because it was so difficult to travel all around Tibet, they decided that, you know, why put all of the relics of the holy person in one place when it's so difficult, and people really need that inspiration, okay? So let's make many stupas around and put parts of the relics in many different places to give more people the opportunity to come to this holy place and be inspired and get comfort. So that's my understanding of the history of why stupas then, you know, like with every other tradition, whatever's valuable kind of grows and grows to be a little bit bigger, a little bit more ornate. And now the stupas, if you look at it during the day, you'll see many, many different symbols on it. And just like with the tankas, each of the symbols and the colors represent some qualities that we aspire to achieve to become enlightened. Any other questions? Over here.
With the Buddha.
Okay, one moment. We'll get you the microphone. Thank you for your patience.
The Buddha that we're talking about, mm-hmm. he was one of a long line of Buddhas. Had he not felt possibly that the earlier Buddhas had not found enlightenment, and that's why he decided he wanted to kind of fine-tune it? And if that's the case, Buddhas that follow him, are they fine-tuning it even more than what this gentleman did?
That's a very good question, and that shows that the Western way of thinking, and maybe other places, is a little different than this Buddhist way of thinking. It's not like the Pope, you know, because I was raised Catholic, so I'm using that example, okay. So there's a Pope, he's the head of the whole church, and when he passes away, there's another Pope, he's the head of the church. So there's like a one at a time kind of thing. Remember, the Buddha means an enlightened being, okay? So he wasn't following someone in an individual chain in that way. And then, your question was, did he think that he had to redo it because the previous ones hadn't gotten it right, which is also a very common thing in faith, you know, the like Protestant faith, you know, the King Henry didn't like the way it was going, so he started a new one, and then, you know, there's some people don't agree in how that's going, so they start a new one and a new one, okay? Buddhism is not that way. It's an experience. It's a personal experience. What someone who is fully realized has worked very hard at understanding, finally understanding how things are, how, why we suffer and how we can avoid it, how we can have peaceful minds. They learn it through hard work, studying, thinking, and experimenting in their own lives, experiencing that those truths that they are finding out. Nobody can do it for somebody else. So he's not saying that he's not doing it better than the previous Buddhas or the other ones that existed at the time. He just happened to be someone who had the capacity to have that experience and the capacity for sharing it for others.
May I offer an elaboration on your answer?
Sure.
So I think something to keep in mind about Buddhism, and I think your metaphor about Einstein is brilliant. Einstein didn't create quantum physics, right? He just found a way to say it and to make it real, right? And it wasn't really that he was saying that Newton was wrong, although Newton was wrong at certain levels of reality, right? Newtonian physics works perfectly well for most of the universe as we perceive it. But as our perceptions have been refined, we needed quantum physics to understand the universe more greatly. Does that make sense? But we couldn't, Newton could not have intuited, well, maybe he could have, but he didn't intuit quantum physics, the math for quantum physics, right? So I think the thing to remember about the lineage of teachers and the Buddhas across time and space is that Buddhism is eminently practical. It's for its moment in time, right? So this Buddha, the historical Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, he was a product of his time and place. So Buddhas prior to him may not have had access to people who, like Ananda, who had the capacity to follow him, who then had the capacity to figure out how to write it down, right? The very invention of the written word may not have existed. And so that's what he did.
Thank you very much. Okay. So our time is moving on here. Any other questions before we go on? Oh, one more.
You're probably going to cover this, but you said there's different forms of Buddhism.
Yes.
You're going to cover that this evening?
I think that's for next week.
Okay. And I just had one kind of a generic question.
Yes.
What language is this that these articles are written in? Is this a is it Tibetan, or is it languages for Buddhism?
I think most of those are written in Sanskrit,
okay,
but it could be also Tibetan. They look alike to me.
Okay, I was just curious. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all.
Thank you very much. Okay, so it's about 10 minutes to 8, and I want to touch a little bit now on meditation. So, what does it mean to you? There is no teaching that says you must meditate. You will not find anywhere in the Buddhist teachings you have to meditate. But it said that if you do, it will help you. It's highly recommended. So, who can tell me, give me a definition of meditation? Kind of shy. Most people think, oh, a meditation is to sit and be quiet and empty your mind. That seems to be the most popular view of meditation. In Buddhism, meditation comes from the word gom, which means to become familiar with virtuous thought. This is a gompa, remember? Okay? Our teacher, Geshe Gelug, says there are three kinds: the concentration, review, and analysis. Other sources combine that into two, absorption and analysis. Okay, so what is this all about? So in order to achieve great things in your mind, to be able to learn, to study, you have to be able to concentrate, right? So that's why the first kind of meditation is concentrating. We all have what's called the monkey mind, jumping from one thought to another. Oh, I'm going to go to the store, I'm going to get some apples. Oh, I wonder how the flood is doing over in around the other side of the world. Oh, I saw a really nice boat. Gee, maybe I ought to go fishing. You know, so here you are going from the grocery store to fishing, right? Like, how does that happen? Okay, so that's what we call the monkey mind. Another important analogy in Buddhism is viewing the mind as a wild elephant. An elephant. We talk about the elephants in the room, right? Well, in Buddhism, the elephant is our mind. Now, we're going to talk about this more later, but what is the mind? In the West, we think that the mind is our brain, right? If you ask a Tibetan, if you ask a Westerner, where's your mind? We all point here, right? You ask a Tibetan, where's your mind? They'll point here. So the mind is the non-physical part of us. Okay? It's not just a brain. The brain is a part of it. But the mind is all that is not physical. Our emotions, our thoughts, our attitudes, everything that is not physical. So in the elephant is controls us if we don't control it, right? The mind is very powerful. It can take us to places that we really don't want to go without even moving, right? So in order to be able to do what we want it to do, have it do what we want it to do, we have to control it. So concentration, you start by using a rope of mindfulness and attaching it to a post of an object of concentration to tame this mind of ours and use it to our advantage. Then you can direct where it's going to go. So, first, concentration meditation, it's the first step in controlling your mind instead of letting it control you. We just talked about the monkey mind, huh? And I guess I knew what the next slide was going to say, huh? Okay. So that's the first goal of meditation. Now, the seven-point meditation posture. Again, the star means that you can download a sheet about the 7 points. You do not have to be sitting cross-legged on the floor in order to meditate. You can meditate in any position. You can meditate while you're walking. You can meditate while you're just sitting. You can meditate while you're doing the dishes, if you have trained your mind to be able to do that. But if we're beginners, why has it been passed down through thousands of years that the ideal way to at least start doing it is to watch these 7 points, which is what we're going to review. It's very, very important that when you are learning anything in Buddhism, that you understand why you are doing it. You should never try to make yourself do something or think something that doesn't feel right, that doesn't feel comfortable, that doesn't feel sensible, okay? There are times when you might feel, well, I don't fully understand this, but it feels right and it's making me more peaceful. Okay, it's helping my mind. It's okay to do that. But if at any point you are encountering an idea or something that you feel like, oh, this doesn't feel right, this is making me more tense and more unhappy, then you stop. Okay? So, the 7-point meditation, the reason this has come down, I'll explain each one of these points, and you use what feels right to you. The first thing is your legs should either be crossed like a tailor, okay? Some people are flexible enough to put their feet up on each other, not the sides, and I can't do that, okay? But you could sit this way, or you can sit with your feet flat on the floor. Your legs should feel comfortable, not dangling. They should be positioned so that you can rest them and forget about them. Okay? And the reason that this way is recommended, is that people who have been sitting this way for a long time and their legs have gotten comfortable doing it, it gives you some stability. You're not going to fall over, okay? And that's the reason for this position. It's a lot harder for most of us in the West who have been raised sitting in traditional chairs. And also, when you're sitting with your legs like this, you should have your hips elevated a little bit so that your spine is in the right alignment, okay? But the next is the arms. The arms should be out a little bit so that air can circulate, okay? And everything about these positions won't make the biggest difference in the world to you at the beginning when you're just meditating for 1 minute or 3 minutes or 10 minutes. But the hope is that we train our bodies and our minds in a way that will be appropriate to grow for years to come. Okay, so you start out with the little things in the good habit so that these good habits can grow and grow and you understand why you're doing it. So you stabilize yourself with your legs like this or flat on the floor. You leave your arms open so the air can circulate. In our tradition, we put the top of the right hand into the palm of the left hand and rest it on our lap. Some traditions, they prefer to put open palms on their knees. Okay, either one, whatever's most comfortable to the spine. Okay, the point is to have your hands resting comfortably so that ultimately you can forget about them. They're supporting themselves. And the next thing, the back, it's important to have it in straight alignment. Here in the West, we're so accustomed to sitting, slumping in chairs that it might take you a while, of weeks and months of making yourself sit in a good posture and your back not hurt, because we're so used to slumping. But once you have gotten that habit and you imagine your spine like stacked coins, then your skeleton can do what it's meant to do, which is support itself. When our bodies are in alignment, it can support itself, so your muscles can relax. And when your muscles can relax, then your mind can relax. That's the whole point of this recommended posture. And again, if it just can't work for you, there's some people who have physical anomalies. I had some friends with scoliosis. It's really hard for them to do this. But that, if you understand the point of it, you can get your own perfect posture. Now the eyes, they recommend no matter what posture you choose, the ideal is to be able to have them very slightly open, to just let in a little bit of light without a lot of distraction, so that you're not tempted to fall asleep. But it's hard for most people to just keep them lightly closed. It's okay to close them lightly, not squeezing them shut, to kind of reduce distraction, visual distractions. The jaw and the mouth should be relaxed. The tongue should be on the roof of the mouth behind the top teeth. The reason for that, it keeps your mouth from drying out. And your head should be, in the best alignment with your spine, just very slightly forward, not too far back, or not too far forward. Okay, it'll throw you out of alignment. So that is the reason for this 7-point posture that's recommended. Any questions? Maybe I better pull my chair next to my notes here. Okay. So we're going to start with a brief meditation called Relaxing and Scanning the Body. And again, this is a handout that you can use to practice at home. When you're beginning meditation, first thing you need to do is to reel our thoughts in. And amazingly, even though our bodies are in here, sometimes we're not even aware that our bodies are in here, because our brain is all over the place and thinking, oh, what are we going to do when I get home, and what did I do, and I wonder if the cat's okay. And so, if somebody else looks and say, hey, your body's here, but you go, oh, yeah, I'm here. Okay? So the first thing we need to do is reel ourselves in and think back. You know, we drove in here, we parked the car, got out of the car, we walked in, we came, and we are sitting in this place. Look down. Here's my legs and my arms. My body is here. Then you put your brain back in your head. Okay? My brain is in here. And then we start this process. So, focus your attention on your breathing. Breathe naturally. Become present in the moment and place where you are. Just focus the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. Create an altruistic motivation for the meditation session. Think that you are meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you are taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. Focus your attention on your physical body. Find the most suitable sitting position for meditation with your spine straight and erect, a position in which you can be aware and awake, but not stiff and rigid. Shift around if you need to a little bit. Focus your attention on the top of your head. move down slowly through the head, the skull, back of the head, the ears. Release any tension in your brow. Move down through your face, checking the jaw to see if you're holding or clenching any tension there. Just keep a normal, natural breath moving through your system when you're doing this. Each time you exhale, just relax a little bit more into this posture, letting go any tension, any anxiety. Move down through the neck and shoulders where a lot of our tension is stored. Check these areas. Down through the arms, elbows and wrists, and the hands and fingers, letting go of anything you're holding there. Move down through your torso, releasing any tension from your back, your chest, just breathing into it. Your waist, your hips, your buttocks, releasing the tension in your thighs, your knees, just breathing into any discomfort you might feel there, expanding the space that is there. Release any tension in your legs, your ankles, and feet. Let go all the way out through your toes. Take a moment now to focus on the most lower part of your body that comes into contact with your cushion or chair. Feel the substance of your body as it makes that contact. Feel the weight and substance of this physical form. Note places where one part of your body is touching another. Note any discomfort you may feel in your body. Just notice this. There's no need to fix things or have judgments or opinions. We are just noticing as we scan the body. And as you notice, you can see if you can bring a bit more relaxation, a bit more of the breath into those places. Note your breathing, the movement of the abdomen or the chest as the air is moving in and moving out. Notice the curve of the arms, the shoulders, the body. Relax and take a deep breath. Release any lasting tension. Finally, dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. You may bring your attention back to the room. One thing that people ask about is, they say, you know, I really can meditate better when I'm looking at a candle or listening to soft music or studying a flower. Is that okay? Yes, of course that is okay. So why is there such a focus on the breath? Again, we're trying to instill and develop good habits from the very beginning that will serve us well throughout our lives. And using the breath is using a tool that is always with you. So if you can focus and use your attention on your breath, you can get into a habit of no matter where you are, if you're down the road and somebody cuts in front of you and you get all tension, you just want to focus and relax, you will have learned how to use your breath. Whether you're in a cathedral or in your room at home or anywhere, your breath is always with you. So that is the reason for the emphasis on using the breath. Are there any questions about meditation? A question there, Henny?
Hi, I'm really new to meditation and yes. Buddhism, so that's why I'm here.
Oh, welcome.
But thank you. When I try to meditate, like I just went on the floor now, I'm trying to strengthen my back. Mm-hmm. It really hurts because I'm used to slouching. So What do you recommend? Just keep at it and eventually it won't hurt as much anymore? Do I need to do crunches to strengthen my core? I don't know what to do to keep the right posture.
Yes, that's a very good question, and I can identify 100% with your problem because I also had very poor posture, and it really honestly took years before it felt comfortable for me to sit upright like this with my legs like this. It took a long, long time. So here's what our teacher says. He says, meditate. When you meditate, stop while it still feels good, and it might be 1 minute. So if you just get in the habit every day, I'm going to sit down, you know, whatever's the best time of day, you know, when you first get up or right after you brush your teeth or just before bed, whatever is the best time of day for you, say every day I'm going to meditate 1 minute, and you do it. Before you know it, it's going to be 2 minutes. Then it's 3 minutes. Then it's five, okay? But don't start out with 5 minutes is all you physically and mentally can handle is one, okay? Stop when it's a positive experience, because our teacher says if you wait until you're miserable, then you're just never going to want to do it, okay? You're just going to think, oh, gosh, it's like torture. But if you just sat down for 1 minute and go, wow, that felt really great, I'm going to do it again, that's the way to do it. And that is how you're going to train your body as well. And I can tell you, you're going to feel enormous benefits to a good posture. You know, as you get older, you know, as we're all growing older, that when I'm a retired nurse, and I can tell you that I saw many older people who had developed a lot of physical problems because as they age, and they start out with a slump like this, and then by the time, you know, 10 years later, they're like this. And then their center of gravity is off. They fall more easily. They don't breathe as well. They don't digest as well. So do yourself a favor. Even if you think of it a physical basis, you will benefit. But your mind's going to too. Good question. Thank you. Any other questions?
So this beginning meditation, is this the kind of concentration meditation? Because you said there are three.
Yes.
So does this belong to the concentration one?
Yes. The first step to be able to go to the studying and analysis, you have to be able to concentrate. When you're trying to learn how to do math or read, first you have to be able to bring your mind in and read the book, right? And to think about how to do it. So all of these things are to train your body and your mind to be in one place and to focus on one thing. Once you're able to focus, then there are many other kinds of meditations that you can do. And it said that when your body is relaxed, your mind is flexible. And it's in that flexibility that you will be able to think about things and study and analyze.
Follow-up question, and this beginning meditation is a part where you free up your mind. So you, with your relaxation, you let go of thoughts and deconcentrate, more or less, in order to enable yourself later on to concentrate on certain things.
I hear what you're saying. You're interpreting the pulling in as letting go. And in a way that's right, but what you're doing is you're letting go of the branches that you're hopping. Okay? So that's what you're letting go of. You're letting go of that jumpiness, of that distraction. Okay? So that's the letting go part. But really what you're doing is you're letting that those branches go so that you can be in the space that you are, on the one thing, in the one place, being able to place your mind on one thing at a time. It's really hard. Thank you. Any other questions? No? Well, it's about 8:15, and I know that people would much rather be left to go early than late, right? But we are first going to review this little cartoon. We are just so hard on ourselves. This is meditation, be gentle with yourself, and you can't read all these things, but I'll bet you can identify with them all. Just keep breathing. Is it possible to die of itchiness? I guess I'm about to find out. I can hear at least 250 of them. I categorically refuse to move. This is not my idea of a good way to donate blood. So this is the path of liberation. Ah! Okay, so this is what we all go through when we all think that we're going to try to teach ourselves how to meditate. So like we said, if 1 minute is a golden minute, stop it there, okay? Make this a positive experience for yourself. Be gentle. If we were all expert, we wouldn't be here, okay? So next week, we are going to review the history of Buddhism. We're going to talk about the Buddhist view of mind, which is not brain, right? It's what's non-physical. We're going to talk a little bit more about meditation. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Four Noble Truths and what it means to be a Buddhist. So, let's see what else next here. A reminder, go to our website, nadampa-center.org, under spiritual programs. You'll see, actually now I think it's under a title that's called Introductory Classes, and then it comes to Buddhism in a Nutshell. There is a book in the bookstore that you can get that's Buddhism in a Nutshell. And I'm not sure if that last thing is still correct. Is that true, that we still go to this website for us?
I think you could still do that, yeah.
Okay.
I think the weekly announcements still come through that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to stay around here afterward. And you can also email me at any time at outreach@kadampacenter.org. Thank you all so much for giving up some valuable time of your day to come here. And let's dedicate all our efforts to improving our own minds, so that we can then in turn improve the world around us. Thank you very much.